This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Texas oil guys are not sitting around crying every day thinking, oh my God, I'm so worried about the unemployed people in California. What could we do? What could we do to help them get jobs? I'm so worried about the people in Watts. How can they be better employed? I know, let's come up with a ballot measure. That is not what's happening here.
This week on Sea Change Radio, our California election special. All eyes are trained on the most populous state in the union as it votes on two separate measures with far-reaching environmental implications. First, we'll explore Prop 19, the ballot measure that would provide for the control and regulation of marijuana. People have heard many of the arguments for legalization, but Sea Change Radio takes a sustainability perspective on the issue and talks with the bill's sponsor, Tom Amiano, and the director of the leading legalization advocacy group in the country, Alan St. Pierre. Next, Sea Change Radio hears from one of our favorite guests, Van Jones, who has been active in the No on 23 campaign. Learn about Prop 23 and why so many in California are trying to stop Texas oil from determining the state's climate future. I'm Alex Wise. This is Sea Change Radio. First, we talked to California Assemblyman Tom Amiano, who, in addition to his 14 years as a San Francisco supervisor, was a school teacher and a stand-up comic. So, Tom, you're the person who proposed this marijuana legalization bill here in California, known as Prop 19.
Right. I did the bill, and then Richard Lee, you know, from Oakland, has sponsored the initiative.
Well, I'm going to read you the ballot title. It's Proposition 19 is legalizes marijuana under California but not federal law, permits local governments to regulate and tax commercial production, distribution, and sale of marijuana. And the official summary is it allows people 21 years old or older to possess, cultivate, or transport marijuana for personal use, permits local governments to regulate and tax commercial production and sale of marijuana to people 21 years old or older, prohibits people from possessing marijuana on school grounds, using it in public, smoking it while minors are present, or providing it to anyone under 21 years old, maintains current prohibitions against driving while impaired. So that's California Proposition 19. And when it first popped up on the radar over a year ago, it wasn't given much of a shot to pass by many members of the media. But now it's looking like it has a good chance to pass, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it got its cheers, believe me. But and then it got cheers. The interesting thing about this whole issue, 19, just the legalization issue, it's not quite the wedge issue or the black and white issue that people thought. There's been a lot of movement, a lot of softening on the issue. Of course, it's very libertarian, you know. They've always liked it. And then there's that libertarian strain in the Republican Party.
And then a lot of law enforcement has started coming out.
Yeah, it's not monolithic. The opposition is not monolithic anymore. I mean, there's still pitfalls and challenges and alarm tactics and all the usual hazarai, you know. But basically, the conversation is sustainable, and there's no doubt in some way or form, you know, there will be a liberalization of marijuana laws. You know, basically, we try to make it short and sweet. So it's... With no regulation, you know, you have chaos, and with prohibition comes chaos in the form of the cartels, $14 billion industry with no economic benefit to the state, and then the other side of the coin is regulation brings some control, and for years people have been putting their heads in the sand about this issue. And so finally, I think it's coming to its own, and we will see significant change in the near future.
One of the things that environmentalists are touting in this bill, Prop 19, is that it's a chance to finally regulate how the marijuana crop, a significant part of California's agricultural sector, legal or not, is grown and to improve current practices.
No, they rape the land, and then they pollute the water sources. It's very, very, very bad. And then the pesticide use, and then the quality, we don't know. You know, there's no standard. But this isn't so much that, it's just, you know, not caring. You know, one of the adjunct issues for me, in addition to the environment, sentencing reform and people's lives being ruined, you know, for minor abuses in and around marijuana and the overcrowding of the prisons and the tremendous cost, you know. And wouldn't it be great to take some of that cost and score it on the side of environmental practices for the state of California that they may not be able to do right now because of a lack of funding?
That's California Assemblyman Tom Amiano. I'm Alex Wise, and this is Sea Change Radio.
Excuse me while I light my spirit. Oh God, I got to take a lift. From reality, I just can't drift. That's why I'm staying with this riff. Take it easy.
Lord, take it easy. This is Sea Change Radio. I'm Alex Wise. Next, we hear from the executive director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, better known as NORML, Alan St. Pierre. Alan, talk about the environmental aspects behind legalization of marijuana in California and in other states.
Well, there's two components of it. There is the legalization of marijuana for consumers and medicinal patients, and the drug quality plant, how it's grown, where it's grown. There's that component, and that's surely in play in the discussion in Prop 19 right now. But in a separate but hardly segregated discussion is the discussion around industrial hemp, the non-psychoactive strain of marijuana historically known as hemp, where if the plant has 1% below tetrahydrocannabinol in all of the world, Canada, England, France, China, Japan, in all of these countries, despite marijuana not being legal in any of them, you can grow industrial hemp for upwards of 10,000 purposes in the United States that could be used for everything from paper to fuel to fodder to fabric to all kinds of industrial oils and lubricants. So from an environmental point of view, it is almost a no-brainer that Americans and American business should be embracing industrial hemp. And when it comes to growing the drug quality of the plant, well, when it's grown illegally outdoors, for example, and the two examples are whether it's domestic growers who just simply don't care about the fact that they're diverting a stream or that they're going out in the middle of the woods and hitting their plants with, again, I'll use a brand name like Roundup as an insecticide, or that they're going out and over-fertilizing their plot, therefore over-fertilizing some of the other plants around them, or in the case of those who are non-domestic growers, and what I mean here are, and there have been plenty of examples of mainly Central and South Americans, often Mexicans, coming into the United States and then setting up large outdoor grow operations in state and federal forests. And in many cases, they seriously trash the environment with all kinds of, shall we say, less than organic practices. And this is for the detriment of the environment and not a good stewardship by those of us who, while we're here on this earth, are supposed to take care of it as best we can. And so because cannabis is and will be grown, it should be grown in an environmentally responsible way. And growing it outdoors and not doing it in a responsible way, diverting streams, using all kinds of chemicals that you otherwise would never be introducing into the wild, that should cease. But that will not happen until cannabis is regulated and taxed like other known agricultural commodities.
Living in a single room with three other individuals. One of them was a male, and the other two, well, the other two were females. God only knows what they were up to in there. And furthermore, Susan, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised to learn that all four of them habitually smoke marijuana cigarettes. Reefers.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Please feel free to check out our website if you have a chance at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or via our website. You can also follow us on Twitter or join our Facebook group. Now back to my conversation with the executive director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, Alan St. Pierre. We heard, Alan, about spraying not only pesticides to keep pests away, but in the 80s, part of the drug war, I don't know if it how prevalent it was, but it definitely seeped into the conscience of the American household, was that marijuana coming from Colombia or Mexico was sprayed with, I forget, was it paraquat?
Paraquat,
which was something that you didn't want to be smoking. And if anybody had seen an after-school special, it would lead to things like leaping off buildings and et cetera. So there was a lot of reefer madness scare tactics that went along with that. Has that practice subsided? And what kind of environmental impact does that have? And moving forward with legalization, how would practices like that be curbed?
Sure, and this is a major concern for forward-thinking people about the environment and drug policy and criminal justice. One, paraquat came about because the United States government provided this massive defoliant that it could no longer legally use in this country and could not even use in war in Southeast Asia, but because of the lax environmental laws in Central and South America, including Mexico, we shipped barrels and barrels of the product for the Mexican army to go and try to destroy the massive fields of marijuana, but it didn't. It just simply, as you indicated in your question, sort of largely poisoned and contaminated the marijuana, which still came into the United States market and consumed because, it wasn't regulated and controlled. If it came into the United States and was tested, like other products are, and it was anything other than safe, then it wouldn't be allowed in the United States.
I had an interesting conversation with some people here in California about Proposition 19, and they actually are medical marijuana card holders, and they are against it. And they said they were going to vote no. And I said, why is that? And they said, well, my grower is against it. And I don't really know much more about it, but if my grower is against it, I think it might not be a good thing. And what would you say to that person?
In trying to employ that the perfect should not be the enemy of the good, cannabis consumers or just lovers of liberty should be always supporting initiatives that move the reform ball forward, even if they happen to, for their own particular parochial reasons, not like some aspect of the reforms. That person is unfortunately misinformed about how very good the passage of Prop 19 is going to be for not only the quality and access to cannabis, be it for medical purposes or not, but most importantly here, and this is the fulcrum this entire discussion really should be based on, economics. Right now, despite medical marijuana being legal for 14 years in California, it is priced exactly at the same price per gram that I can purchase illegally here in Washington, D.C., one block from the White House, from a bike courier. It's the same price. This is obscene when grown outdoors, these products are worth pennies on the pound, like corn and sorghum and barley and hops. All of these products sell dollars to the ton on the free market in the logical world absent prohibition. And if it is to be forced by government to grow indoors, well, we've already crunched those numbers at normal. We've taken a look and actually been to 60,000 square foot grow operations, some of them legal, some of them not. And what are the numbers there? About $1 to $1.20 a gram to produce. And most of that is in the electricity, is in the water, is in the nutrients, and frankly, most of that cost is in the humans that have to interface with the plant, who have to put the clone in or the seed, who have to maintain it, who have to ultimately have to clip it, dry it, and package it. And even with all of that, that drives the cost up to $1 to $1.20 per gram, which means adding on a profit margin, which everybody's entitled to, and a reasonable degree of taxes, these products should be costing about $2, $3 a gram, not $15, not $20, not $25 a gram. So when that grower told the patient they were against it, well, why? Because they are still making $15 to $25 a gram for something that illogically should never cost this much. In fact, he would sound very much like a tulip seller in the Netherlands 300 years ago trying to convince the buyer that it is still worth selling out thousands and thousands of dollars for vegetable matter. Back then it was tulips. Today it's cannabis.
So what do you think the price would be?
I think the price is probably going to be about $30 for an ounce of very low quality cannabis, that there may be an additional $3 to $4 of taxes associated with that, and that just like we have for alcohol, the higher the quality, or in this case measured by potency, the higher the potency, the greater degree of taxation.
Alan, I know that there's a lot of estimates for what kind of revenue might come in from a tax standpoint, but have you tried to calculate the environmental impact and how that will be affected by a legalization situation like California's Prop 19 passing?
The effect of marijuana on the environment is such a broad topic, it would be hard to sort of nail down these numbers in a satisfactory way. For example, if the American farmer can grow industrial hemp, then that can be made into fuel. And so what are the macro dynamics of the American farmer being able to grow a biofuel? Right now they're doing it with corn. Huh, well, we don't eat hemp, but we do eat corn. Corn is a very, very important part of the food chain here in the United States and all around the world, and for other industrial purposes.
That's the executive director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, Alan St. Pierre. I'm Alex Wise, and this is Sea Change Radio.
Marijuana. I like marijuana, but you like marijuana. We like marijuana too.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Another 2010 California ballot measure important to environmentally conscious people is Prop 23, an effort to reverse California's landmark AB 32 of 2006. I recently spoke with one of the leaders of the Green Jobs Movement, Van Jones, about the bill. One of the things that you've been evangelizing about and a lot of people have been working on in the last couple months is Proposition 23. What does it mean for all of us, do you think?
Well, for people who are keeping up with it, this is this horrible ballot measure. Essentially, it's Texas oil money jumping over into California politics to knock out Silicon Valley as a competitor in the energy future. In California, on a bipartisan basis with a Democratic legislature and a Republican governor, the people of California came up with something called AB 32, which was a law and basically a roadway, a pathway to clean energy and green prosperity for the state. As a result, there are 500,000 people who are working right now in California, who have jobs right now in California, wouldn't have them otherwise. There's been a tidal wave, a flood of clean tech dollars and investment into the state. And suddenly, and so it's working. It's probably the only part of California that's working both politically and economically is the commitment to a clean energy future. Unfortunately, these Texas oil guys have jumped in and have put this very confusing ballot measure on called Prop 23, which pretends to be for climate solutions, but just wants to delay the implementation of climate solutions until unemployment is at some minuscule level. And it's strictly a play on the part of Texas Oil to knock out California innovators as a challenge and a threat to their dominance of the energy future for America.
This is not just a big oil against the green movement kind of conflict. There's a few rogue players. When you say Texas Oil, there's Valero and Tesoro and the Koch brothers. But other industry players like Chevron, Shell, brand names that we know, they actually aren't supporting Prop 23, right?
Well, yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, you do have, you know, some very, very bad actors here. And I think that one of the things that is very important for people to understand is that the kind of use and abuse of, you know, big donations in politics, you know, this whole kind of corruption of our political system by those who want to cling to the dirty energy status quo has to at some point just to be seen for what it is. You know, Texas oil guys are not sitting around crying every day thinking, oh my God, I'm so worried about the unemployed people in California. What could we do? What could we do to help them get jobs? I'm so worried about the people in Watts. How can they be better employed? I know, let's come up with a ballot measure. That is not what's happening here.
If Proposition 23 passes, would it disproportionately impact low-income people and communities of color?
Well, you know, it really does wind up being a license to pollute for the big polluters because, as you know, communities of color suffer first and worst from all the downsides of our pollution-based economy. More asthma, more cancer, more likely to live next to polluting coal-fired power plants. You know, the people suffering first and worst are often low-income people, people of color here and around the world, whether you're talking about Pakistan or whether you're talking about, you know, Katrina, the people who most urgently need us to move off of and move away from these pollution-based energy technologies are low-income people, people of color. And so when you launch an attack on a, you know, visionary piece of job-generating clean energy legislation, not only are you knocking out a jobs future for communities that need jobs, putting up solar panels, weatherizing homes, implementing the technologies of the future, and also not just being workers, but eventually becoming entrepreneurs and owners themselves, not only are you knocking out that jobs future, you're also locking in a negative health future for children who live close to these freeways and polluting power plants. So it's a doubly negative blow for those communities.
Well, I know here in the Bay Area, for example, we think of San Francisco being this paragon of green, and it is doing some pretty progressive things in terms of recycling and its biodiesel program for its mass transit. But just across the bridge in Richmond, there's a huge Chevron refinery, and the people hit hardest by that in terms of their drinking water and asthma and other externalities. It's one of the harshest places right there in the country, right?
You know, you hit the nail on the head, and that's one of the things I love about this program is that you're willing to look at the positives and the negatives. Even in, you know, the sort of, you know, green mecca, you can still see some of those injustices and, you know, some of those, you know, contradictions where you literally have the worst of the past and the best of the future right there together. What we've got to be focused on is to make sure that the Texas oil guys can't put a ceiling on the positive part of that future. And then that gives us the opportunity to kind of begin to erase some of the negative from the past. But, you know, it is, the case that if we think about it the right way, a clean energy future isn't just good for the polar bears and future generations and 1,000 years from now. It's really about work and wealth and health today for people. It's about not just the PhDs, but also the PhDs. You know, none of these solar panels are going to put themselves up. That's good, honest work for somebody. These wind turbines don't manufacture themselves, they don't put themselves up, and they don't repair themselves. That's jobs, that's contracts, that's entrepreneurial opportunities for people right now who are looking for good, honest work. Homes don't retrofit or weatherize themselves. Nobody, you know, homes don't put in their own insulation. Homes don't caulk their own windows. That is work that is done by people who are trained to put on, you know, hard hats and work boots and pick up the lunch pail and go and make America better. And so, you know, Prop 23, you know, really has created a ladder not only to enhance environmental performance in California, but also to enhance the economic opportunity in California. And the idea that Californians should kick their own ladder over, and really the only ladder that California has right now that's stable and that's you know, working to kick their own ladder over at the behest of Texas oil companies is just ridiculous.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Now back to our discussion with the author of The Green Collar Economy, Van Jones. You helped launch a program in the East Bay called the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, which has actually been at the forefront of the Stop Prop 23 campaign. Can you tell us something about what the center does to mitigate the detrimental impact to at-risk communities?
Well, you know, this is an extraordinary thing, and I can say so because I've been gone from the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights for, you know, three or more years. But, you know, it used to be the case that if you had one of these so-called environmental measures on the ballot, you know, you might expect to see only the environmental organizations, you know, squaring off with maybe, you know, the big polluters. And you've seen that story a million times. What the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, and really with the leadership of Ian Kim, has been able to pull off is bringing a new voice to the table. Again, those people who hurt first and worst in the pollution-based economy and get hit first and worst in the pollution-based economy don't want to then benefit last and least in the clean energy economy. And those are the poor, low-income, people of color, women, all those communities that often are left out are speaking up, and they're speaking up through this campaign that the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights is helping to lead. And I think it's very healthy development, and I think that one of the things that I think environmentalists and especially people who are in the clean tech field have to understand is two things. One, we're never going to get where we need to go 100% without the government having smarter policies. And number two, the government will never have smarter policies if Greens don't have smarter politics. And smarter politics must recognize that California, for instance, is already a majority-minority state. There are already more African Americans, Latinos, and Asians collectively in California than there are white voters, which means, white people, I should say, which means that we've got to begin to expand this green tent to include more kinds of voices. And as goes California, so goes the nation. A big pillar in the Green Growth Alliance and the Clean Energy Alliance will increasingly have to be made up of people of color.
What do you think Proposition 23 says about the push and pull between the green movement and big business?
Well, I mean, I think that the push and pull between the green movement and big business is probably not the right frame. I mean, it's the green movement plus all of the forward-thinking business community versus a tiny rump of folks who are clinging to the pollution-based status quo because they're greedy and they want to maintain domination of our energy future based on oil and coal because that's what they sell.
Van Jones is currently a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, teaches at Princeton University, and is a senior policy advisor at Green for All. You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Jimmy McGriff, Jimi Hendrix, Grateful Dead, David Peel, and Wes Montgomery. Thanks to our guests, Tom Amiano, Alan St. Pierre, and Van Jones. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Bounty Growing System, Sungevity Home Solar Specialists, Invisible Structures, a socially responsible paving company, Kuva Coffee Company, and 100 Watt Network. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.